Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, reviewing the U.S. fight against ISIS. Possible scenarios for the crisis in Yemen. A terrorist threat against U.S. shopping malls. And we have a little fun with Internet hygiene.
What do you think is the most common password in use?
Password.
Almost. Password is number two.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter is holding talks in Kuwait with top U.S. commanders and diplomats on U.S. efforts to fight the Islamic State group. He arrived Sunday from Afghanistan, where he viewed plans to withdraw U.S. troops from the country within 2 years. He met with U.S. soldiers and received briefings on the status of coalition efforts to train, advise, and assist Afghan forces. Carter, who met with U.S. military and Afghan political leaders, said the United States is rethinking details of its mission in Afghanistan, including whether to slow down the withdrawal of U.S. troops, whose mission is changing from combat to training as Afghan troops take on responsibility for fighting the Taliban. About 10,000 U.S. troops are in Afghanistan. That is expected to be halved at the end of the year and reduced to embassy security at the end of 2016. Carter told reporters prior to his arrival in Kuwait, he is trying to assess the situation in Iraq, Syria, and the region more generally. His meeting at a U.S. base in Kuwait comes amid concerns the Islamic State influence has spread to Libya. RAND Corporation analyst Jonah Blank tells VOA's Victor Beatty he doubts there will be any major change in military strategy.
I think that there is no clear military strategy for defeating ISIL, because this is not primarily a military battle. And I think all of the military experts and all of the diplomatic experts will say some variant of the same thing. We can only do a limited amount with military action. The real thrust of the action is going to come through diplomacy and through other forms of engagement.
Is it possible Mr. Carter will soon be asked to make a recommendation about whether to send U.S. forces closer to the fight, possibly as spotters for airstrikes?
I think it's likely that he will be called upon to make some sort of a recommendation, whether called upon by the White House or by the Pentagon itself, because I think that U.S. policy will really need some clarity on just what role U.S. military forces are going to be playing in this struggle going forward.
The Pentagon, of course, is preparing to start training Syrian rebels next month at sites outside Syria. That's obviously a new component in the fight against IS.
However, CIA has been training similar groups, according to published reports, and the degree to which the Pentagon training will be changing the dynamic, I think, remains to be seen. The moderate Syrian opposition is not a very powerful force, and the numbers that we're talking about, 5,000 a year is one common estimate, are just not really a game changer, at least in the near term.
Over the weekend, Mr. Carter was in Kandahar in southern Afghanistan. There appears to be growing concerns about the possibility that a base used by U.S. forces in Kandahar will be shut down later this year. Are there growing concerns that the de-escalation of U.S. presence in Afghanistan is going too quickly?
Yes, and those concerns are coming from within the U.S. military and particularly within the Afghan military and civilian government. The U.S. military, as well as partner militaries in ISAF, have provided a lot more than combat troops. They've most crucially provided what are sometimes called enablers, the air support, the medevac, the logistics, the sort of things that enable an infantry, a modern infantry, to operate.
Kandahar is also the center of the Taliban insurgency. Would a U.S. absence pose real challenges to the Afghan national forces?
The most important thing that the U.S. can provide, in my view, is this enabler function. That is, the U.S. currently provides a lot of support from the air, and a lot of other things that the Afghan National Security Forces currently are not able to do or are not able to do very well. These are vital missions, things like evacuating wounded personnel from the battlefield. So I don't think we're really going to be talking about U.S. ground troops getting involved in combat. However, I think that there is a significant chance that the current configuration of the U.S. providing some very specialized support, particularly in terms of air power, that maybe that will go on a little bit longer than had been originally planned.
Blank says there is concern the U.S. not repeat its total withdrawal from Iraq before the political and security situations are stabilized. A recently approved United Nations Security Council resolution is calling on all sides in Yemen to settle disputes that are preventing a solution to the country's political crisis. The resolution urges rival factions to end violence and renounce provocative actions that could undermine the establishment of a stable government. The resolution, however, is generally seen as weak. A provision that would have provided enforcement measures has dropped during negotiation after Russia objected, and events in Yemen suggest it is being largely ignored as the country slides toward greater instability. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with former U.S. Ambassador to Yemen, Barbara Bodine, about possible scenarios for Yemen.
I think what was interesting is that the U.N. called for a peaceful resolution, which is the only viable path out of this crisis. I'm not terribly surprised that the Houthis rejected up front a call for them to withdraw and turn in their weapons, but I think this is only the beginning of the political process and does not spell the end of it.
Would a UN intervention help or complicate the Yemeni crisis?
If by intervention do you mean a UN military force going into Yemen, I think that would be a very serious setback. I'm not sure what the forces would do, which element of this fluid political situation they would support. I don't think the UN wants to take over and run Yemen. As difficult as it has been, there is a political process that is still underway, and putting boots on the ground, either UN boots or a coalition of boots or even regional boots on the ground, would vastly complicate and not resolve the situation.
With this stalemate, would it be eventually a civil war in Yemen?
That's an extremely difficult question. It is possible. Yemen is not at that stage yet. Again, you've got the Houthis, a very fragmented southern movement. You've got other political players, and it hasn't squared off as a civil war scenario. Interestingly, again, this is largely being debated, contested, sometimes with violence, but largely contested as a political debate, not necessarily a classic civil war as we too tragically see in Syria and as appears to be developing or has developed in Libya. It's not to say that it could not sink to that level. It's not quite there yet, and so the UN call or reminder to all parties for a peaceful resolution is probably the only path forward and is also the best path forward. Yemen would not survive a civil war.
Could the rise of Shiite Houthis in Yemen using force push some Sunni tribes to join forces with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula as a counterbalance?
I think it is possible that some tribes may do that, but I think it would be a very short-term alliance. One of the things that the Houthis do need to do as part of this peaceful resolution, however it is configured, is to find a way to make it clear that this is an all-Yemen effort at a resolution and not allow it to be framed as a Sunni-Shia fight. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is not a political actor in Yemen. They should not be part of the peaceful resolution. And I would suggest to any Sunni tribe that believes that that is an appropriate ally, that they are being very short-sighted as to their own interests, much less the interest of Yemen.
Do you envision a possible ISIS in Yemen following these developments if it failed?
I think the possibility of extreme elements in Yemen who don't see al-Qaeda as being successful could align themselves with ISIS. We've seen this in Libya. It's entirely possible that that could emerge if the political and the security situation stalemates.
Final question. What policy options does the United States have to prevent a failed state in Yemen or a prolonged civil war if it happens?
I mean, the United States has some options, but one of them is not military force. It's not traumatic. It takes a long time. But I do think that putting full support behind a Yemeni-brokered political settlement really is in everyone's best interest. I would support the idea of talking with Houthi political elements. There are political elements. They were part of the national dialogue, as well as talking with some of the other major players in Yemen. But ultimately, the solution is going to be Yemeni. Where the United States and others come in and play a very key role is whatever the political solution is, that the international community must be there to help Yemen with economic development, with jobs, with moving the transition to a viable, legitimate governing structure. Because if we don't get to the day after the political settlement, then the political settlement cannot survive.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Yemen, Barbara Bodine. Although U.S. Homeland Security officials say there is no credible threat against domestic shopping malls, the head of U.S. Homeland Security says authorities take a threat issued by the Somali-based militant group Al-Shabaab seriously. It has called for Muslims to attack Western shopping malls, among them the Minnesota-based Mall of America. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, appearing Sunday on U.S. television, was reacting to a video released by Al-Shabaab terrorists.
We've seen this a number of times now where a group will call for an attack, and so we've got to be vigilant. So we ramp up security. There was a call for an attack on locations in Canada and Europe, and so in response to that, I ramped up the presence of the Federal Protective Service at federal buildings a couple of months ago. I'm sure that security at this particular mall will be enhanced in ways visible and not visible. But it also involves public vigilance and public awareness. If you see something, say something, has to be more than a slogan.
Johnson says such terrorist groups are making use of publications, videos, social media, and the Internet to publicize their messages and threats. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for a September 2013 attack that killed 67 people at the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi, Kenya. A Minnesota man was indicted last week on charges of conspiring to support the Islamic State extremist group and lying to federal agents investigating recruitment by militant groups. Prosecutors say dozens of people from Minnesota, many of them Somali Americans, have traveled or attempted to travel overseas to support groups such as Islamic State or Al-Shabaab since 2007.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
To read the headlines these days is to get the sense that the Internet has become a scary place. Cyber espionage and identity theft abound, while organized criminals and national spies lurk. As President Barack Obama recently said at a California summit, cybersecurity is an issue of paramount importance and one that everyone, from governments to private firms to individuals, needs to address. But how can one person fight back against the skills of highly sophisticated cyber criminals or the resources of nation states? VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard joins us now with a few suggestions.
Well, first off, Susan, it's important to remember that we're not saying that people should be afraid of going onto the Internet, but they should be aware that there are a lot of bad actors out there. And there are things that people can do to protect themselves. Now, nothing is foolproof. This isn't a guarantee that one will never be hacked. But I think just by implementing what Internet pioneer Vint Cerf calls good web hygiene, I think a lot of smaller, more petty hacks actually can be avoided.
So what's the first one you're going to suggest?
So the first one is your password, hardening your password. So just for a minute, Susan, I want you, and I'm going to give you a little hint here. What do you think is the most common password in use?
Password.
Almost. Password is number two. In Splash Data's annual ranking of passwords, the most common password is 123456.
But everybody hates to come up with those complicated passwords, and then you can't remember them, and then they don't want you to do the same password for everything, and then you get all confused, and then you write them down, and then they get mad at you for writing them down.
That's exactly right. And you just mentioned several things there that you should not do. Yes, look, passwords are complicated. And frankly, look, they're a bit of a pain. But having first a hardened password is really crucially important. A soft password is like putting a piece of cardboard over your door instead of where you would put the lock. So you want uppercase, you want lowercase, you do want some digits in there, maybe some special characters, and for heaven's sakes, don't do something like write your pet's name, you know, with a one at like Fluffykins 1 or something like that. That is not a hard password.
Okay, what's next?
Well, the next is what I call changing it up. I think when people finally do get a hard password, something that's relatively complicated, but something that they have in their head that they can remember, they, one, never change it, and two, they use it for all of their services. This is almost worse, I think, than having a soft password, because once the bad guys crack your password, notice I said once, not if, because no password is unbreakable. Once they crack your password, now they have access to everything, your bank accounts, your medical records, everything that you have, very personal stuff. So you don't want to give the bad guy hackers that kind of access. So once you do get a relatively hard password, remember to change it up a little bit now and then and see if you can just modify it, perhaps just a bit, to simplify things service to service.
And what's your next one?
The next one is something we call watch what you click. We all know, I hope by this point, that if you get an email from somebody that you don't know with a link that you didn't ask for, that you should never, never, never click on that link.
But I get so curious.
And everybody does. And this is actually, we read a lot about Chinese hackers, how sophisticated they are. Well, this is actually the number one way that Chinese hackers break into relatively sophisticated corporate cybersecurity by sending out, it's called phishing attack. If you have 100 people and 99 don't click on that link, but one does, that's all it takes. So it's very important to remember that if somebody that you don't know sends you something, a file, a link, very often it'll be, hey, check this out, or you'll want to see this. For heaven's sakes, just delete it right away.
I get the one that says, thank you very much for your donation, or you have won.
Right. Well, see, those are a little bit smarter, aren't they? And even if you get a link like that from somebody you know, let's say a colleague, a work colleague, or a friend sends you a brief link, hey, check this out, I would actually contact that person a different way to say, did you really mean to send this? What is this that you're sending? I know curiosity gets the better of us, but try not to.
Okay. VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard will share more of his tips Tuesday on International Edition. If you can't wait till then, see his fuller list of Internet hygiene habits in his column, 11 Ways to Keep Yourself Safe Online. It's all at voanews.com. Birdman, a film about an aging former superhero actor starring Michael Keaton, won the Oscar for the Best Picture Sunday at the 87th Annual Academy Awards. The Oscar Best Actor went to Eddie Redmayne for his heartbreaking performance as famed physicist Stephen Hawking in The Theory of Everything. Julianne Moore earned the Oscar for Best Actress as a woman who receives an Alzheimer's diagnosis in Still Alice. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to look up Doug's story there. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On February 23rd, 532, Byzantine Emperor Justinian I ordered the building of the iconic Hagia Sophia Basilica in Constantinople. February 23rd, 1455, is said to be the date of the first publication of the Gutenberg Bible, the first Western book printed with movable type. In 1778, German-born Baron Friedrich Wilhelm von Steuben arrived at Valley Forge, Pennsylvania during the American Revolutionary War to help train the Continental Army. In 1836, 6,000 troops under the leadership of Mexican President and General Antonio López de Santa Anna laid siege on the Alamo, a small fortified mission in present-day Texas. The siege ended 13 days later with a Mexican army assault, resulting in the deaths of all of the defenders. On this day in 1893, German engineer Rudolf Diesel received a patent for a version of the internal combustion engine. Diesel engines became popular for use in early motorcycles and automobiles. In 1898, Émile Zola was imprisoned in France after writing J'accuse, a letter accusing the French government of anti-Semitism and wrongfully imprisoning Captain Alfred Dreyfus. In 1903, Cuba leased Guantanamo Bay to the United States in perpetuity. The life-saving polio vaccine developed by Dr. Jonas Salk got its first mass application on this day in 1954. A group of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania schoolchildren received the first injections of the Salk vaccine. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains deeply concerned about the well-being of the North Korean people. Special Envoy for North Korean Human Rights Issues Robert King said, "The United States seeks to alleviate the humanitarian problems in North Korea and also to end the egregious human rights violations occurring in the country." Between 1995 and 2008, the United States provided North Korea with over $1.3 billion in aid, both in the form of food and heavy fuel oil. But in early 2009, North Korea unilaterally terminated the U.S. assistance program. Just 2 months later, North Korea conducted its second nuclear weapons test. The 2014 support of the UN Commission of Inquiry, or COI, on North Korea's human rights situation noted the deplorable use of food by the North Korean government as a means of controlling its population. According to the COI, North Korea's leaders are guilty of knowingly causing prolonged starvation and are responsible for the death by starvation of hundreds of thousands of its own people. The need for food, medical, technical, and educational aid remains urgent in North Korea. North Korea has set up roadblocks to government-to-government engagement, but has demonstrated a willingness to work directly with NGOs. The U.S. supports these NGO efforts. The U.S. believes direct people-to-people contact, which occurs through the provision of humanitarian aid, can have a positive long-term impact on advancing change in the country. That's why the U.S. calls on North Korea to honor its international obligations and agreements and to allow international humanitarian assistance groups and independent monitors unfettered access to all areas of the country to ensure that humanitarian aid reaches its intended recipients. Ultimately, said Special Envoy King, we will judge North Korea not by its words but by its actions, the concrete steps it takes to address the core concerns of the international community, from its nuclear program to its human rights violations and its effort for the well-being of the North Korean people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.